welcome to episode 3 of Science Amplified. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Rachel Marsh, professor of psychology at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Marsh completed her undergraduate degree at Skidmore College and obtained her PhD in experimental psychology at the City University of New York, better known as CUNY. She is an expert in fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is an imaging tool to measure brain activity non-invasively by detecting change in blood flow. Dr. Marsh is especially well known for her work with children, studying obsessive-compulsive behaviors that develop in childhood, and with dyads, scanning both mothers and their babies to identify whether certain brain-based markers are passed intergenerationally. I'm so excited for you to hear about her work, but I wanted to explain a few things that will be mentioned so that we're all on the same page. Dr. Marsh refers to Danny a few times. This is her collaborator, Danny Dimitriou, also professor and pediatrician at Columbia University. We also mentioned a few NIH grants. T32s are training grants that are awarded to universities to support a number of postdoctoral fellows. They don't support all postdocs. Usually they're competitive within the university, and they only support a limited number of people. These grants can be a huge help to hire more staff because a regular NIH grant actually doesn't cover that much. A lot of people probably don't realize that each lab in a university or research institute has their own individual budget, and we, the investigators, have to find the funds to pay for our staff from grants. So that means that if these grants are eliminated with no notice, which is what's happening right now, that a lot of people will have to be laid off because there's no money to pay them anymore. We also mentioned a grant called NRSAs. These are also training grants, but they're individual fellowships that a postdoc can apply for by themselves, and they get judged at the NIH individually. They're very competitive and hard to get, but it also means that if you get it, your salary is paid from the NIH and not out of the main lab budget. So again, if these grants are terminated without a lot of prior notice, it can be hard or impossible for a lab to come up with the funds to keep paying this person. So I think that's it. Today's conversation is really interesting because it focuses on an area of science that I think many people are really interested in, which is how stress in moms impacts their children. I know that this is something my friends worry about a lot. Everyone is trying to manage their stress while pregnant, and cortisol, the stress hormone, is basically a buzzword in the debate about sleep training. So if this episode impacts you or is meaningful to you, or you think the research is really important and should be done, please contact your elected representatives and ask them to fight for restored NIH funding for science and for scientists. Enjoy the show. So I figured we could start, you know, just generally by you telling me, like, introducing yourself and a little bit about how you got involved in science and why, you know, you chose this career.
So my name is Rachel Marsh, and I'm a full professor at Columbia University in the Department of Psychiatry. I'm trained as a psychologist, an experimental psychologist with a focus on developmental psychology and cognitive neuroscience. I started my postdoc there really wanting to understand what was going on in the minds of young children before they had language, and immediately got involved in studies that my mentor had conducted at Yale before he came on OCD and anxiety, Tourette syndrome, childhood psychiatric disorders. Basically, most of the research in my lab focuses on the concept of self-regulation and how it develops gradually over childhood. And how many disorders are characterized by poor self-regulatory control that likely manifests in certain behaviors that are controllable but difficult to control. I got involved with Danny's project because we met at an ACMP and we hit it off. We became friends. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hit and she was working on the front lines in the Well Baby Nursery at New York Presbyterian. And noticing that these babies who were born to COVID-positive moms were asymptomatic and PCR negative. And we thought, oh my gosh, we better do something. So we got together, we wrote a grant. It was miraculously funded on the first submission because it was so important to understand what was going on with these children. during this super stressful time for the parent, right? And for the, you know, the child. We worked with Catherine Monk, who's a perinatal psychologist and another very good friend of ours at Columbia. And we got this grant, and Danny did an amazing job of rapidly mobilizing so many people from so many different departments to establish the COVID Mother Baby Outcomes Study. And in that study, in that grant, we were really focusing on socio-emotional processes like connection between the mother and the baby, considering that, you know, these babies were basically at the height of the pandemic taken away from their mothers. So there was no time for mother-infant bonding. And what was that going to do both to the mom's maternal health and to the baby's long-term outcome? So initially, we were looking at the effect of in utero exposure to SARS on neurodevelopmental outcomes, but that quickly became, it quickly became apparent that it wasn't just, you know, the placenta is an amazing barrier. It wasn't the exposure to SARS. It was really the maternal stress that was having the most impact on the child's neurodevelopmental outcomes. I am a neuroimager. I'm a pediatric neuroimager. So my role in that study was acquiring all the MRI data from both the mothers and the babies who were doing these dyadic scans. I have an amazing team. I had so many like volunteers from Barnard who were doing their like summer research institute projects, all these undergrads that were so involved in like helping us get the babies to sleep before we put them in the scanner, because we don't sedate babies. We just rock them to sleep. Very long, very arduous scan because we're scanning the mom, scanning the baby. We managed to bypass so many hurdles. I mean, we currently have a data set right now. I think we have 79 mothers and babies, and we were trying to get to 100. And the current administration, they, you know, it's my understanding that they searched through grants with bad words and the pandemic. Why focus on the pandemic? Why focus on COVID? Why was anybody masking? What's the point? Infectious diseases, who cares? Let's study chronic diseases instead. So they took the grant away.
I guess from what it sounds like I'm hearing, it sounds like the focus is not really even on COVID at this point. It's more using COVID as a proxy for what happens when babies and mothers are
separated at birth. And, you know, what that does to just, you know, even if they're separated right after birth, a few months later, what is the bonding like? And we know that bonding is so integral to socio-emotional development, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, these kids are very unique in that they grew up at this time. And so them terminating this grant makes it impossible for us to continue following these children. And the other thing is that, you know, we've done an amazing service to the community in which we work. In Washington Heights, all these mothers, they were approached in the delivery ward, like they were approached to consent to the study, and they could consent either to just do the surveys or they can consent to do the MRI portion. The MRI portion is just one portion that this grant funded, but of the whole combo initiative. I mean, and these parents are so involved and so appreciative because we're showing them through our data, through our many publications thus far from the combo initiative, that their babies are going to be okay. The fact that they had COVID during pregnancy, it's going to be okay as long as they remain calm, you know? And I feel like, it, you know, it's a really nice way to be able to give back to the community to show them that, like, even though this was so unprecedented, this pandemic and all the, you know, the subsequent effects of the pandemic, the isolation brought onto families and children, especially if you think about singleton kids who didn't have any siblings at home, you know, what's going to happen to them? And, you know, this is what we're invested in studying. And now we're having difficulty. We're going to have to lay off staff.
For, you know, people that aren't familiar, I mean, including me, I'm not really familiar with the research. So what outcomes have you seen so far from these studies? And what are you still trying to do? Like, how long term were these studies planned or are they planned to be?
Right. So, I mean, we've been applying or trying to apply for other grants to follow these kids longitudinally, because right now, I mean, babies born at the height of the pandemic, they're turning five. And I typically put a kid back in the scanner when they're like five or six. Mm-hmm. Toddlers are very hard to scan. They move around a lot. But we're pretty good at getting like early school age kids to scan. So that's sort of the next step, what we want to do. We have published, well, Danny's group has published a bunch of papers on the impact of maternal stress, either prenatal, postnatal, on neurodevelopmental outcomes at 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. And everything seems to be okay, except for the impact of the stress. Mm-hmm. It's not the in utero exposure. And she's in one paper, we compared our COVID sample to a historical control group. So we were able to isolate the effects of stress because of the pandemic. She had there was another data set at Columbia University of babies that were, you know, scanned or that were, you know, studied immediately after birth.
Oh, I
and
see.
During the pandemic. So we were able to sort of isolate the effects of pandemic related stress on neurodevelopmental outcomes. And so with the data that I'd been acquiring, the imaging data, I mean, there were many things we were wanting to do with it. First, we were wanting to maybe index, you know, look how the mother's brain might be impacting the child's brain, the baby's brain, and, you know, really looking at socio-emotional circuits in relation to like the measures of maternal bonding, both by self-report and by video assessments of mother-infant bonding. And seeing how that might alter, you know, socio-emotional development in the baby. So there are many things that we've been trying to do. I mean, we're pretty lucky because when it got terminated, we do have a data set of 79 dyads. So that's publishable. That's great. Right now, we're going to put all the resources we have in our labs towards analyzing those data, which is hard without the grant, as you know, but the public probably doesn't know. I mean, you know, Danny has some... private funding that we're trying to use to help bridge some people who could help us with the data analysis. I have an endowment that I'm trying to decap, which is a terrible thing to have to do, but, you know, I don't want to get rid of my postdocs.
Yeah. And I'm curious, though, you know, there was, aside from the specific grants that were terminated, there's also been, of course, this talk about reducing indirect funds. And I'm assuming, but I don't know, so I'm curious for you to tell me that a lot of the equipment that you use for scanning is maintained or covered by indirects. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how indirects and changes to indirects would also impact what you're doing.
Right. A lot. I mean, so we have staff that, you know, run the scanners that, you know, are in charge of the equipment that are needed for the image acquisition. And those people are funded by the department, not by my grants. So, you know, what's going to happen? That means that we're going to have to use the grant funding, if we ever get grants again, to support that aspect of the research in addition to what we normally support with the grants. So, and I mean, although it does seem like a lot of money, $500,000 a year, which is the NIH cap, that doesn't go very far because we also have to support our own salaries. We have to support all of our trainees and the research staff. So if we have to support aspects of the scanner hardware as well, that's not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I want to make it, you know, something really clear for people that, you know, and correct me if I'm maybe mischaracterizing it, but, you know, in theory, the current administration has set this goal for chronic diseases, solving chronic diseases. And so many of the diseases that plague our society now are these neurodevelopmental disorders that we don't really understand why the rates have risen so much over the years. And so to me, it sounds like the research you're doing is actually directly beneficial towards these goals and seems almost counterintuitive towards.
Yeah, it's all counterintuitive. Yeah. I mean, and let alone the fact, and I know I think I mentioned this to you in my email. I mean, all of our training grants were terminated.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I think it was because of that control find or the Musk AI software that was used to search for anything with a diversity component. And all of the T32s, the ones that I'm familiar with, the NIH-funded T32s, the postdoctoral training fellowships, the applications originally required us to have a state very clear about how we were going to enhance diversity of our applicants, of our trainees, and of our mentor, you know, a mentoring team.
Yeah.
So because of that, those were all cut. So now we have these scientists and physician scientists who were, you know, dedicating time towards training to become experts in research to, and, you know, enhance their clinical practice, and they're now not going to be trained. It's like unbelievable. So we're having to use our grant funding to support these trainees who were supposed to be supported on these training grants.
Yeah, it seems so counterintuitive to the goals that they've set. I wanted to ask because I was talking to someone today who said, someone like in science who is definitely following what's going on. And they were like, oh, but I thought Columbia had all their funding restored. And I was like, I don't think so. So I think no one even knows what's happening. So thanks.
No, we definitely haven't had anything restored. I mean, we were asked to make a case for each grant, but nothing's happened so far.
I see.
I mean, I'm co-director of one of these NIMH T32s, and our renewal application, we had a perfect score. And that's not going to be funded. So now we have to submit it again with the hopes of maybe it being viewed, you know, again with the perfect score without any of that diversity language.
That's so crazy.
It's so crazy. And I don't know if you've ever been involved in writing one of these T32s. They're a beast.
No, I haven't. But I was on a T32 when I was a PhD student. And I was funded by a K99 diversity award. So,
well, yeah, it's terrible. I mean, I had an MD PhD student whose NRSA was taken away. I mean, there's so many people. And it, you know, it's really the worst part is that it does seem like a targeted attack on the next generation of scientists, because that's who's going to be impacted the most.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and at least in the case of Columbia, it just seems like a way to cause, an attempt to cause the institution as a whole pain.
Yeah.
Without any care, you know, not only for the scientists, but for the science that's going to be lost. And, you know, honestly, for all the taxpayer dollars that have already been poured into this research, for that to now, you know, potentially go down the drain is an incredible waste.
Incredible waste. Incredible waste. And I have to say, like, I'm a Jewish professor at Columbia, right? I mean, I think I should mention that. It's, you know, when I saw the pro-Palestinian protests, of course, you know, I wasn't happy about it. But, you know, I didn't find it anti-Semitic. It's anti-Zionist. And I don't know if you want to go into that. But then all of a sudden, we're being punished for that on the medical campus, which was so, it's 30 blocks away. Like, there were no protests happening up by us, right?
Yeah.
But we're getting our biomedical research funding taken away. It's insane.
It's totally crazy. So I want to just, we jumped straight to the research that was cut, but I was hoping that you could also give a short thing about just the, you know, other research that you've done, the impact that it's had. I want people to really get a sense of what you do and why it's important.
Yeah. So unrelated to the combo study, like I was saying earlier, I study self-regulatory deficits in children. Right now we have a clinical trial that, thank God, was not impacted by this just yet. It's little kids with OCD. And we are doing this cognitive control training with them on iPads, like something super tractable. Like, you know, kid comes home, can I have an iPad? Sure, you can have this, and it might help your brain. And it's training their cognitive control processes with the idea that, you know, children with OCD, they need a little cognitive control in order to sit through exposure therapy, first line therapy for them. And we've actually been seeing that their symptoms are lessening as they play these games. And we're also scanning them before and after. And we have about another year to go on this study. So we're not done yet, and we haven't looked at the imaging data yet, but we're really excited at the idea that it's actually helping the children. It's a tool that the FDA approved for kids with ADHD, but it's never been explored in any other diagnostic entity. So,
and what do they actually do when they're playing the game?
Like, it's called Akili. It might have a new name now. And what it is, it's just an iPad game where they have to go through these missions and they have to ignore distractors in order to get to the goal. And, you know, it's a fun game. It's kind of like, if you think about like Temple Run, like something like a kid wants to play super fast, they're getting rewarded there, you know? And it's really tapping into these different cognitive control processes that we know are sort of dysfunctional in OCD. And we know what parts of the brain support these processes. And we've seen alterations in those neural networks, in those circuits before. And we know that, you know, they're pretty much markers of treatment response if we think about CBT. So, yeah, we sort of put all that together and that's what we're doing. And I mean, I would like to extend that type of work to the combo study because we have so many kids that are already enrolled and the retention is so great because these people are so thankful for what we've done for them throughout the pandemic. And so we're trying to write more grants now to have them come in to see if we can maybe use this type of app, which is so kid friendly. I mean, my 10-year-old was piloting it for me and she like didn't want to put it down. So I knew like this could really work. Like how easy would it be if we could just hand a kid an iPad and prevent the development of a disorder? So that's really where I want to go with it.
Yeah. It's a very interesting process because I feel like, you know, parents hear so many different recommendations and it's always like no screen time. iPads are bad. So yeah. It's very interesting to hear that you can potentially use these things for positive.
Right. I mean, it's very hard to limit screens for children. I mean, I know as a mom of three, it's very, very difficult. But if you can turn it into make it something that is helpful or useful for them, why not?
Yeah, for sure. Right. Well, okay. Is there anything else you want to share?
No. I mean, I just that I think that what you're doing is amazing. I agree that the public really needs to know what the ramifications of this is, you know, both, you know, for the science, the scientists, and for like the next generation of children, because we're just trying to help kids. Right? We're trying to help families. We're trying to help children be better members of society. And, you know, I don't know why we're being stopped.
I think this is a very like interesting interview for me because I think, you know, I'm a basic researcher who works only with rodents. And, you know, sometimes I think it's hard to explain to the public, you know, the how that will one day translate into something that helps them. But the type of research you do like really doesn't need any explanation. It's automatically clear and automatically gives results that are applicable to people's lives and will help them immediately. So I hope that your funding gets restored soon.
Thank you, Sarah.
And
yeah, but I mean, you know, we just have to keep on trying. I've been in this game for 20 years, you know, and getting a grant has never been easy. And now it's just going to be harder.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But, you know, I'm like, in theory, I should apply for an R01. I mean, I applied and, you know, didn't get a great score, but in theory, I should reapply. But I'm like, I don't know if it's worth my time right now. Like,
I don't know either. I mean, I'm currently working on a foundation grant and I usually don't, but I mean, I feel like we have to try that avenue now while the government's in shambles, you know?
Well, nice chatting with you.
It's me, Sarah. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you all so much for listening to today's episode of Science Amplified. Again, if this show was interesting to you or meaningful, please share it with your friends and family, especially those who may not be familiar with how the scientific research enterprise works in the United States. And please remember to contact your elected representatives and remind them how important science funding is for our country and for the health of everyone we know. So thank you again for listening and have a great day.